Our second reading is also from the Old Testament. Surprise. It's the second half of chapter 3 of 1 Samuel. Then the Lord said to Samuel, "See, I am about to do something in Israel that will make both ears of anyone who hears of it tingle. On that day, I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew because his sons were blaspheming God and he did not restrain them. Therefore, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be expiated by sacrifice or offering forever." Samuel lay there until morning. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord. Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. But Eli called Samuel and said, "Samuel, my son." He said, "Here I am." Eli said, "What was it that he told you? Do not hide it from me. May God do so to you, and more also, if you hide anything from me of all that he told you." So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. Then he, being Eli, said, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." As Samuel grew up, the Lord was with him and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was a trustworthy prophet of the Lord. The Lord continued to appear at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God. Please pray with me. Holy God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. I have heard it said that the sound of your own name is one of the sweetest sounds you will ever hear. In fact, our brains activate in a specific way when we hear our names called, rather than the names of other people. Some people call it the cocktail party effect, where you hear your name in another conversation and suddenly you're like leaning this way, trying to catch bits of what someone's saying about you without being too obvious. From an early age, we are predisposed to hear our names as a form of our meaning and significance, a form of our own personhood. The science behind this isn't broken down for us, of course, in the narrative of this biblical text that uses various naming moments, but God does have a tendency to call people's names in times of change or personal recognition. People like Moses and Paul and Zacchaeus are a few examples of this kind of naming. And God calls out Samuel's name too in our text, and his life is never the same after this. Samuel was the oldest child of a woman named Hannah, one of the wives of a man named Elkanah. She was the favorite of his two wives, and 1 Samuel tells us that her womb had closed. This trope echoes the experiences of other matriarchs like Sarah and Rebecca, both of whom were also favored wives and matriarchs in the family of Israel. All three of these women went to great lengths to conceive. Hannah, in deep lament, came to the temple to pray. And Eli, her priest, thought that she was drunk because she was praying and weeping so loud. That very day, she promises that her son, if she is blessed to have one, will serve God with his life if only God would relieve her infertility and give her a child. And God grants her this request, and she becomes pregnant with none other than Samuel, the boy in this story. And as she promised, she gives Samuel to the temple for God's service. And the prophet, who thought she was a drunkard, ends up becoming the guardian of her son and begins his training in the temple from a young age. This background about Samuel matters because his calling started the moment his mother wept in the temple, longing for a child. She is a prophet like Mary, who bursts into song when God fulfills this promise for her. She prophesies about the ministry of her son and the coming changes that will happen because of the work he will do. So Samuel's moment does not just occur out of the blue. Behind him stands the legacy of these women longing for children. His mentor, who is nearly blind, and his God, preparing him for that encounter in the temple that night. Like his birth narrative, the historical moment he's in is also unusual and may sound a little familiar to our own context. So Israel is not a nation yet. It's a grouping of nation states that are all vying for power. It is based on the 12 tribes of Israel, of course, which would assume a unity, but they don't have it. Their descendants have spread throughout the regions, and judges, or chieftains, lead different groups. The only time they band together is when they are afraid of attack or when they are attacking someone else. They're consistently fending off other people from attacking them or attempting to enslave them. And to create a semblance of order, these judges or chieftains take care of social and political matters like war and wisdom and judgment. And 1 Samuel 3 describes this kind of chaotic time as a time when visions and the word of the Lord were not widespread. The hallmarks of this period of history include disorder, priestly anemia or apathy, and splintered power. The book of Judges tells us that everyone does what is right in their own eyes during this time of leadership. And Judges goes on to tell us that this happens because there isn't a king, as if that is the excuse for all the lack of unity. But the priests keep going with their rituals. They keep up with their prayers and their sacrifices. But visions are unusual, and apparently so is the word of the Lord, despite all of their praying and sacrificing. Does any of this sound familiar to you? A lack of unity? Rallying cries only in times of crisis? Or forgetting to listen to God's call? Not even knowing how to train our ears in the first place? I know I hear this in the rhetoric that comes after horrific incidents, in the endless thoughts and prayers you might see on social media platforms, or in the shaking of heads with a lack of follow-through, or the wringing of hands in another time of death or disease. All of it a cycle of flooded emotions, compassion fatigue, and uncertainty about what to do that would make the situation better. Samuel is growing and learning in this kind of chaos, this kind of where is God landscape. But he serves and lives with Eli in the temple, learning the rituals that he needs to follow the vocation that his mother chose for him. He falls asleep in the temple, which I doubt was really his room, but I love imagining young Eli wandering the temple at night, fascinated by the lamp burning all night. Eli's in his room, partially blind, and Samuel has fallen asleep in this temple. It is during one of these nights, a night most like the others in his life, that he hears a voice. Now remember, the word of the Lord was rare in those days, and visions were not widespread. So our dutiful Samuel goes to his elder, Eli, and says, "You called to me?" Now Eli is getting up in years and cannot see as well as he once could, and Eli, unfamiliar with how God's voice might sound to Samuel's ears, tells him to go back to sleep. But God calls out to Samuel again. Samuel. He comes again to Eli, and Eli sends him back to bed. And finally, at the third round, Eli has a discernment moment of his own. He realizes who is calling to Samuel in the temple, where the Ark of the Covenant is. It is no surprise to me that it is this holy place alone, where a child should not be sleeping, that Samuel hears the voice of God. Sometimes that is how it works, doesn't it? The places that some of us were told we should not tread, that they were too holy for our feet, or we should tread with caution, we end up encountering God. And that is what happens to our friend Samuel. The Hebrew scholar Valerie Bridgman says that Eli mentors Samuel into hearing God's voice. I don't know if I can give Eli that much credit, but I will say that he does, in fact, know how to tune his ear to it after a while. And I can relate to Eli's lack of attention. Sometimes it takes a while for all of us to notice that God is speaking to us. He encourages Samuel to head back to the temple, and he does. And this time, Samuel doesn't say what he said before. This time, he says what Eli told him to say. Speak, for your servant is listening. He says exactly what Samuel told him to, and this time God is not just a voice, a disembodied voice. The text tells us that the Lord is standing in front of Samuel. God has come to Samuel with a very physical presence, one that gives a word to Samuel that he must deliver, regardless of what the consequences might be. The word that God gives for Samuel for his first prophecy isn't a good one. It is a word that does not come for him, but for his elder, Eli. An anonymous prophet told Eli earlier that God would judge him and his sons because Eli did not stop them from stealing the best parts of the sacrificial animals for their own tables. They were eating the best pieces of the animals at home with their families. And rather than stopping them from stealing, Eli does not do anything. Eli allows them to do this. And God is displeased by the greed and selfishness of the priests. So God appears to Samuel and delivers this message. God gives this word to him as his first prophecy as a young boy, probably less than 12 years old. When I realized this, I said to myself, really? God wants to send Samuel in there to say that? Did that really have to be the beginning of his ministry, to speak this judgment upon an elderly man, nearly blind, someone who has cared for him and mentored him? And the answer is yes, you may have guessed it. Yes, Samuel must go in there and speak this truth. He must go in and share these consequences with this man, and he must go in there and tell this hard word to his mentor and guardian. You may have noticed, too, that Samuel doesn't rush back to Eli's room this time. He actually spends the night in the temple. Previously, when he heard his name being called, he couldn't wait to run and see what Eli needed. Three times he runs into Eli's room to see how he could help. And now, when God appears and tells him what to do, he falls asleep again. Imagine Samuel, afraid or confused, emboldened, feeling loyal. He remains in the temple all night. And the text tells us in the morning, he opens the doors to the temple first. He doesn't even go check on Eli to see if he's awake. He pauses for a moment, and then he tells him exactly what God said that night. And Eli, in humility and obedience, accepts the hard word from God. He does not argue with it. Eli receives what God has for him. You see, spiritual discernment requires us to act at some point or another. It does take attentive listening and a commitment to listening for a voice that is not our own. And yes, it takes the humility of an open mind and an open heart. And sometimes discernment happens on our own, in the middle of the woods, in the poetry from another tradition, in a song at a folk concert. Doesn't really matter. It happens wherever we are. And all throughout the story of Samuel's life, people are making discernment-based decisions, following the tug of God's Spirit wherever it takes them. Like his mother, Hannah, who knows before he is born that Samuel does not belong to her, but to God and to God's service. Eli knows that God is calling out to Samuel and tells him the words that he needs to say in God's presence. And Samuel listens to God's words for him, recounting them to his mentor, sharing the first hard truth of his ministry. God gives all of us a word to share, whether it's a message that comes to you in a time of lament, like Hannah, a message that we do not understand the first few times, like Eli, a message that requires us to speak truth to power, like Samuel does, because discernment doesn't work the same way in every person. It works in our lives and in our hearts differently. None of us are exactly the same, so why would God give us formulas for how God would interact with us? So don't be surprised if your experience of God is different from the person sitting next to you, the person walking down the street, the person you encounter on the train. God comes to us in a myriad of ways in the moment we find ourselves in. This opens us up to experience God's presence in a multitude of ways. Discernment requires action, of course, but we must first be open to what the Spirit is saying before we can make any action. Discernment reveals the tugging of God's Spirit within and around us, compelling us to act. This week in particular, our headlines make me think of Samuel's time and place. The description of the time of Judges seems to fit too closely with our own. Leaders seem to be doing what is right in their own eyes, regardless of what sector they serve in. There is a lack of clear accountability. And sometimes it seems like the moral compass has gone missing. And God's voice can seem distant and easy to confuse with the voices of others. Violence between groups of people do not seem to be ending. And the shooting at the mosque in Christchurch, an explicitly white supremacist terrorist attack, is one more in a hateful string of violence against our Muslim siblings. We are meant to mourn with them and the communities around us, feeling the impacts of violence, whether near or far. A few months ago, the confirmation class visited the Islamic Society of Baltimore on a Friday night for dinner and prayer. They happened to be having their annual winter festival, so families who normally would not have been there that night were there. We could barely find a parking spot because it was so full. The mosque was full of families from a variety of Muslim backgrounds and countries. We heard many languages being spoken, and it is one of the largest mosques in the Baltimore area, and the diversity of the festival reflected that. And we received hospitality and friendship from our hosts. They taught us about the similarities and differences between our tradition and theirs, and they showed us the face of God that night, reminding us that there is hope and friendship across our differences, and that we have more in common than we originally may have thought. It is in those commonalities that we can find solidarity to move forward together against hatred and violence around us. We live in a time when we must speak up like Samuel, even if we are unprepared or afraid of the consequences. Our headlines this week do not leave us any space for turning away from the current moment. The realities that we face as we look at the world around us call us to act rather than turn away. We cannot and must not forget that discernment leads to action. The core wonderings of discernment guide us deeper into the question, what would you have us do, God? As Mary Oliver so wonderfully says, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? During Lent, we are reflecting, after every sermon, on the spiritual practice that we embark on as a community every week. Our practice this week is the practice of discernment, you may have guessed. You'll find a card in your bulletin with the question for today. The question today is, how do you experience clarity when making a decision? We'll have a period of silence to write and reflect on what this means for you in your spiritual journey, and then when the silence is done, we will join together and sing, O Lord, hear my prayer.